And the number of ribs, which I thought was interesting, it's the same as like the number of fingers in Midjourney. If you can recreate the number of ribs accurately, then your model's good. Then we know we've trained it well.
Welcome to The Edge of Infinity, a podcast of builders talking to other builders in the AI space. Together, we discuss where the field is at today and make predictions about how things are going to look like in 5, 10, 100 years' time. I'm your host, Lena Avancini-Colucci. Thanks for joining me as we imagine the future of AI together. Today, our guest is Professor Akshay Chowdhury of Stanford University. Akshay leads the Machine Intelligence for Medical Imaging Group at Stanford. And Akshay and I actually both did our PhDs on MRI at the same time, but on opposite coasts. And during our PhDs, there actually wasn't much deep learning in the field of MRI. The first paper came out maybe middle to end of our studies, but that has certainly changed in the past 7 to 8 years, and Akshay has been a leader in applying deep learning to medical imaging, and so we talk all about that. We start out by talking about one of the coolest applications of stable diffusion that I've seen. What Akshay did is modify stable diffusion to generate synthetic images of chest x-rays, and then he actually trained classifiers on those images. We talk about using deep learning to speed up MRI scans and have them take a fraction of the time that they do today. We talk about ideas for how to make use of the massive data sets that are just sitting in hospital warehouses today. We talk about where the future of computer vision is going. We talk about what Akshay is jealous about that the natural image community has that he wishes he had on the medical imaging side. And then we end by talking about favorite papers from the past 6 months, advice for people wanting to get into the AI space, and then tips for how to stay up to date with the absolute fire hose of AI advancements happening right now. You can find the full show notes, and what I mean by that is the full transcript for this episode, plus links to everything that we talk about. Papers, resources at blog.infinity.ai. And without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Akshay. Akshay, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lena. Excited to be here today.
I wanted to kick things off by rewinding the clock a little bit. I was reflecting back at a conversation we had, and this was back at your birthday party, so back in October. And you made a comment that diffusion models were the most exciting technology that you had seen in a really long time. And so just to orient ourselves a little bit, this was about a month after stable diffusion had been released into the world. I wanted to ask, why did you make that comment back then? And is it still true now, 10 months later?
Yeah, it's first of all crazy to think that that statement was less than a year ago. It seems like there's just been so much that's happening in this space, which is just absolutely exciting that, you know, technologies like diffusion models, you know, large language models, the talk of the town, they're enabling so many interesting applications. And if I try to think back to why I may have made that comment, I still think I agree with it. But I just think that some of these generative models that we've been working with for many years, you know, even before the advent of diffusion models, we're working with things like generative adversarial networks. And they had very good performance, but it was always a little bit of a pain to train them. They would always suffer from things like mode collapse. If you train the same model multiple times, you'll probably get substantially different outputs. So I think we're on the precipice of building something great, but it wasn't there yet. And I think that's when this new notion of score-based generative models came by. I thought that was personally exciting because the underlying concepts behind these score-based models is actually beautifully elegant. There's actually not that much that's happening in terms of model training. You take an image, you add a little bit of noise to it, and then you learn to denoise it. You take your noisy image, you add a little bit more noise, and you're simply learning denoising. But if you actually create a nice Markov chain where you add noise iteratively, you can end up with an image that's noise only. And then if you invert that process, you can start creating very high quality images. So I think at the foundation of it, I was just blown away by how simple a concept it was, where you're basically learning a really, really nice regularization function by denoising. And there's a lot of literature around that. So to see that concept being applied to something like generative image creation, I thought was elegant. And I thought that the results that these models produce were beautiful. And I think the last part of why I made that statement back then, and I probably still subscribe to this philosophy, is it's actually really straightforward, or maybe not straightforward, but it's easy to be able to control the generative capabilities of these diffusion models too. So the original diffusion model is unconditional. You start off with an image, you add noise to it, and then you invert that process. And at inference time, if you start with noise, you don't really know what the output would be. But now, what if we had some really powerful text embedding that we can provide? What if we have some image embedding? So this notion of being able to create models that have high quality outputs, models that could be steered using language or other inputs, and models that are relatively easy and stable to train, I think is a trifecta for what we need for good models in the future. So that's what I was excited about less than a year ago, but I think I'm still excited by those very same concepts.
Yeah, so cool. And maybe for the audience, we just talk a little bit about the work you've done of applying these generative models to medical imaging.
Yeah, I mean, I was very surprised at the quality of the images we're able to generate. And what we did for that project was that was a few months or maybe even a few weeks after the stable diffusion model had come out, where you can take in natural prompts like, you know, a dog riding a unicycle in Times Square. And using that prompt, we can actually synthesize a very high quality image that corresponds to that prompt. So we started thinking, well, this model is very powerful, but is it helpful for us? I always try to think about projects with a healthcare focus in mind. You know, that's really the ethos of the research I try to do. Can we build new technologies to be able to help improve how we perform healthcare? So given that the stable diffusion model had really good generative qualities that could be controlled by text, what we tried to do in collaboration with Stability, who are very generous in offering us a lot of compute for this, was being able to see whether we can take this very nice original stable diffusion model and then fine-tune it to be able to synthesize medical images. There's quite a few parameters that we had to optimize for in just trying to understand what part of the model we should be fine-tuning. Is it the text encoder we need to fine-tune? Do we need to fine-tune the VAE? So maybe spare the audience the details for now. But we were shocked that using a few tens of thousands of images of chest x-rays, we now had a model where you could enter in a radiology report and you could synthesize an image that corresponds to this radiology report. And now we've been doing more and more work in that space to try to see whether we can build these generative models where the input is something that's human defined and we can compose prompts in different manners. So I think it's fantastic as a great new tool that can enable a lot more downstream applications in the future.
And you could, using your fine-tuned model, right, you could say, hey, give me a chest x-ray with a pleural effusion or with pneumonia and get pretty accurate, faithful images. Because then what you guys showed is when you trained on just those synthetic images, right, you could get equivalent performance to real world, which is mind-blowing. And then when you train on both, you could get even better kind of classification performance.
Yeah, those were some of our preliminary results. And we're really trying to dig down deeper into what do those results really mean. And we're trying to structure those experiments in a little bit more of a systematic manner. But that's exactly what our initial conclusion was. When we train some of these models with synthetic data, you know, they are usually on par in terms of performance for in-distribution settings. So let's say I train this generative model using data from one particular hospital. Now, if I train a classification model using these synthetic images, the performance of the synthetic images will be similar to the performance of real images for that original hospital. But now when you take a model trained from hospital one and then transfer it to hospital two, we saw that this out-of-distribution performance for models that had seen synthetic data was better. We're still trying to grapple with why that's the case. We're trying to replicate that across multiple different hospitals. So we have quite a few theories, but I think that was something that was pretty exciting. You know, the fact that models trained with synthetic data learn features that potentially generalize a little bit better than using real data itself, I think is a really fascinating concept. And we're trying to dig into some more experiments where we're trying to understand what are these features? Why do they generalize better? If they generalize better, how can we exploit it to build models that have better performance, that are fair, that work for rare disorders? So I think it just opens up a lot of potential areas for exploration. So we're very excited behind that.
Yeah, it's so cool. So this is obviously one aspect of the work you do in your lab. Before we just dive in on one of these, give the audience an overview. What kind of work does your lab do in general at a high level?
Yeah, I think that's a big question too. Over the last 6 months, we've been trying to have a lot of existential questions like this about what sort of work we should be doing. But I think at a very broad level, I try to think about the research that we do in the group as something that can hopefully improve the value of healthcare at the end of the day. And you can define value across different axes. You can define value for different stakeholders. But at the end of the day, we want to be able to make outcomes better for patients. So we want the quality of care to be increased. And at the same time, we want better value in terms of utilization. So can we make healthcare less expensive? Can we make healthcare more accessible? So those really are the very high level questions and motivations that drive a lot of research projects in the group. What that translates to on a day-to-day basis is typically thinking about questions like, how can we make a lot of the imaging studies that we use for imaging diagnostics faster? Specifically, you know, a lot of the research that we do focuses on radiology. I have a large background in magnetic resonance imaging, you know, similar to you. So we've had many nice conversations about that. So despite MRI being a great tool, it's still a little bit inaccessible for major parts of the world. And even in places like the Bay Area, you know, if you go to an average hospital, a hospital can only maybe run 10 to 15 MR scans per day. The reason for that is because each scanning protocol takes anywhere from 30 to 50 minutes of scan time. Mm-hmm. So given some background in the underlying physics, given some background in computer vision, can we actually take this 30 to 50 minute MR slot per patient and then reduce that to 15, 20 minutes or so and try to get the same diagnostic information, or in some cases, even more diagnostic information than what's available? And I am particularly excited by that because it makes MR more of an accessible tool. Mm-hmm. We can scan more patients. Patients have to wait shorter durations to get the clinical answers that they need. So that's a major area of work that excites us. And then at the same time, a lot of these medical images are acquired daily across hospitals. And usually, we're only asking very specific questions as to why we're acquiring those images. You know, for example, if you happen to go to the ER complaining of stomach pain, which is a very common indication for patients presenting to the ER, you might get a CT scan to rule out whether or not you need an appendix. But then after you get the CT, you don't really look at it any further. You mostly, you know, put it in some, you know, cloud warehouse and it sits there. What we're seeing is if you actually take all those images, you combine that information that we can extract from those scans with the patient's medical record, we can actually try to predict what will happen to that patient in 5 years' time, mm-hmm. what will happen to them in a 10-year duration, because we now have this fantastic glimpse into their physiology, into potentially new biomarkers that are predictive of future disorders. So we're trying to do more with the same data sets that we have already. So could we think of this as a potential screening test? And if someone is at a higher risk for disease, let's intervene today when they're relatively healthy, rather than having them present to the hospital for a heart attack, where, you know, the patient outcomes might be worse, there's more cost to the healthcare system. And these are the major application areas of a lot of work we do. And I always like building new technologies to be able to enable some of these questions. So we're very excited by, you know, everything that deep learning has to offer. And we just want to be able to make a lot of these deep learning tools more robust, more generalizable, and have them work even when you don't have large training data sets. So what can we do to understand the representations that can be extracted from these images? So a lot of work focuses on representation learning using images. More recently, what can we do when we have imaging data, language data, medical records data? So a lot of the major application areas we focus on are really driven by what sort of new tools we can build. So maybe a very long answer to that question, but happy to dive into anything deeper too.
No, that was really great. And just because, I mean, this is a topic of interest to me and I want to make sure the audience understands too. Maybe explain what is MRI and why is it the most beautiful imaging modality of all time?
Oh, man. Now I have to pull up some slides for this. I think at Stanford, you could take around 15 to 20 classes just talking about the physics of MRI. But at a very high level, MRI tries to image the hydrogen atoms in your body. Now, each atom is not just a little atom that sits there in the body. It's actually always precessing. So it's kind of like a globe that will always keep spinning. And if we think back to our basic physics lecture, whenever we have a charge that's spinning, it creates a magnetic field orthogonal to the direction of the motion. So all these tiny hydrogen atoms end up creating a magnetic field. And if we think of these atoms as singular units, the magnetic field that's created is very small. It can't really be measured. But when we create these large magnetic resonance imaging devices, they're usually on the order of, 1.5 Teslas or 3 Teslas in terms of the strength of the magnet. And just for reference, that's around, 10,000 times the magnetic field of the Earth. So they're very big magnets. Once we put patients in these magnets, we can actually start measuring these hydrogen signals. And that's essentially the image that we end up creating in MRI, which is a distribution of these hydrogen atoms. And once a patient is in this MR scanner, we can actually perturb that signal in many different ways. And we can image the body with very high resolution and with very high signal contrast. So for example, if I'm trying to look at a slice of my brain, I can have the same slice being imaged with multiple different settings where in some scans, my white matter might look similar to the gray matter. But in a different scan, those two tissues will have very different signal intensities. So the fact that we can generate high resolution images and we can manipulate the image contrast makes it a very powerful tool for diagnostics and prognostication too.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, it's one of the coolest imaging modalities in my mind. There's no known negative side effects, right? No ionizing radiation. And it's stunning how, we can kind of leverage these basic physical properties and literally get these hydrogen atoms, like these water molecules inside your body to give us information about their state and get these beautiful images of the inside of your body. It's still mind-blowing whenever I think about it.
It's amazing to me that it still works because, the type of signal data that we acquire in an MR scanner is not actually an image of the actual brain. So for example, if I'm it's very different than the cameras that we have on our phones. If I'm trying to take a picture of a scene, I can directly capture the photons that come from whatever scene I'm imaging. But in MRI, we end up sampling the Fourier transform of that particular slice. So whenever I deal with the math, I'm so amazed by the fact that we can build magnets to be able to be so sensitive to these hydrogen atoms and then have the mathematical formulations to convert that raw data into something that's meaningful and that's something that we can perceive. So it's beautiful.
Agreed, 100%. So your lab, as you were saying, its overall goal is improving health outcomes, right? And so you have a couple of different ways that you target and approach that overall goal, faster imaging, faster MRI scans. You can use deep learning and different algorithms to do that. Predictive modeling of using information longitudinally across time. You also do very cool work with not just imaging, right, but multimodal and digital health sensors and all of that. And figuring out how deep learning can kind of be used to ask better questions and improve kind of health outcomes. Is that right?
Yeah, maybe I should start using that answer when people ask me, what do I do in my lab? Talk to Lena should be my go-to.
Well, let's project out a little bit. So let's project out 5-10 years. What are some of the ways in which your current work has come to fruition? When I go into a hospital or a clinic, what are some of the things that I'll be able to benefit from because of the work you're doing today.
Yeah, and then I will definitely say that there's a lot of people that are involved in the field, and I'm just one of them. So I think it's a collection of all of our efforts that will really make an impact in healthcare. But something that we're starting to see right now, already in a pretty wide-scale setting, is some of these accelerated MRI protocols that I talked about. So typically, an EMR protocol might take 30 minutes of scan time. We've been working for many years, along with many colleagues around the world, on being able to come up with new methods where we can accelerate that image acquisition. Over the last 2 or 3 years, a lot of the research tools that we've been able to develop have now matured into FDA-cleared products that are available on all the major MR vendors in the world. And many of these tools now are just being used in a routine basis. When patients come into many hospitals that I know of, instead of just running the normal imaging scans, we run the deep learning accelerated scans. And that cycle has been really fascinating to see because, you know, deep learning is relatively nascent. You know, as when we think about timelines for a lot of healthcare applications, you know, the first paper that showed that you can use deep learning to accelerate an MR scan probably came out in 2015, 2016 or so. Mm-hmm. So within a decade, we saw the first paper come out, and then there's already clinical sites that are running these scans daily. So I'm really excited to see how far can we progress with this. Right now, there's only a subset of things we can accelerate, but now, you know, we have a lot more time on our hands, literally, in the MR scanners. How can we make best use of that time? Our initial goals were just to make things faster. But now that we've made things faster, we're generally confident that these methods work. Can we now build more advanced methods to create better imaging sequences than what we had in the past 5 years or so? So we've been working on a lot of work that tries to make MRI scans quantitative. In the past, a lot of imaging has been qualitative. So you might say that in this particular lesion, this particular area in the brain is a lesion because it looks darker than the area next to it, or it looks lighter. And maybe two different radiologists on different days may call that same case differently. So can we start moving away from qualitative imaging to quantitative imaging, where I can say this particular lesion has an apparent diffusion coefficient of X, which is a number we can quantify, which is a number we can repeat across sites. So I really do think that with a lot of these accelerated scanning methodologies, we can get more precise insights into the physiological status of patients. And, you know, hopefully you don't need to get an MR scan in 5-10 years time. But if you do, then we'll be better off than we are today because we're just able to probe earlier in disease processes. We have higher resolutions, we have better sensitivities. So I'm particularly bullish about that. And then the other set of projects that we're working on, which is using some of these imaging data sets for predicting what happens to patients. You know, everyone has been building risk models for years and years time, and there's always something to be learned. But what would make me happy in 5 or 10 years time is not just building these models, but actually trying to implement them in the hospital. So let's say if I think about one of my projects that I'm particularly passionate about, if we have some CT scans of the abdomen, we can quantify things like how much atherosclerosis you have in your vasculature, how much muscle you have, how much fat you have, how fatty your liver is, what is your bone mineral density. All of these are very sensitive biomarkers that we've shown on retrospective data can be predictive of future cardiovascular events. But then a risk model is only really useful if you can intervene in a prospective setting. So I'm particularly excited about some of these nice new technologies being implemented. We're working very closely with a lot of cardiologists who are very excited by this technology. And we're trying to mature some of our algorithms so that we can best communicate our findings with cardiologists so that they can actually intervene with their patients. And we want to track, are these interventions helpful? So even if we find out that our methods aren't useful, that's useful knowledge for the field because the next time around when we develop these tools, we'll have that knowledge, which we don't have right now. So I am very excited to be able to implement some of these tools in prospective clinical studies and really try to quantify, is it helping?
Yeah, and that's such an important point of, you know, risk scores or early detection or, you know, this stuff is only useful in clinical settings, to your point, if you can do something about it, right? And the good news is with a lot of cardiac stuff, there is so much we can do about it, and if we catch it early. Akshay, what do you think? Are there going to be radiologists in the future?
Absolutely. I think we're in a state where a lot of the technologies that we're building will help automate some of the mundane tasks that not just radiologists, but clinicians around the world are doing. You know, if you talk to most of our colleagues who are doctors and ask them, what is it that you spend most of your time on? You know, some common answers might be charting, just writing down interactions with patients. So is that the best use of a clinician's time? Maybe, but is it some time that we could give back to the clinicians by being able to automate some of the tasks? So I think that's the perspective that I have about all these new deep learning-based technologies. Mm-hmm. I don't think they'll necessarily replace people because we still need the human element. We still need the empathy in a lot of medicine. Mm-hmm. But can we provide more time back to the clinician so they have time to think, they have time to interact, have time to be empathetic with patients? So that's how I structure a lot of my studies. You know, how can I best augment our mm-hmm. clinical colleagues? How can we help them be the best versions of themselves by taking away a lot of tasks, which are maybe a little bit mundane, a little bit more monotonous? So understanding that a radiologist does more than just read an image. You know, they always talk to referring providers. They figure out what imaging studies should be done. So I have learned so much just by shadowing people, just being an annoying person behind them and always asking, you know, what are you doing? You know, what is the goal of this? What's the goal of this other activity? And once you immerse yourself in that role, you will see the complexities of a lot of tasks that our clinicians do. And then once we see those complexities, I think our goal as technology creators is how can we unlock our clinical colleagues to be the most efficient and best versions of themselves? So will AI replace radiologists or other clinicians? No, but it'll absolutely make them better.
Interesting. I guess if I can push back a little bit. So I think it always depends on the time frame, right? One thing, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but this one of my favorite books of all time, The Beginning of Infinity, has this concept of project out to infinity. And infinity is a very long time, right? So now we're not talking 5 to 10 years. If I project out to infinity, for example, I think there will be some role for a software engineer, but it certainly won't look like anything that we're doing today. Like, I will not be writing code when we project out to infinity. I'll be doing other things that won't be automated yet. But, you know, I think given a long enough time horizon, right? Do you agree? Like, radiologists and your job and my job, like, they'll all be obsolete.
I mean, I'm happy for someone to come in and take my job so I can just spend most of my time riding bikes and skiing in the winter. Yeah. No, I mean, I think I agree with you. You know, given long enough time scales, everything that we see right now is the way it is because of the technologies that exist around us, you know, whether they're helping us or whether they're limiting us. But if we look at long enough time horizons, we have to adapt to different needs. You know, you brought up the example of software engineers, for example. Mm-hmm. Things like, you know, language models, ChatGPT, Bard, they're making every software engineer more productive. You know, just integrating things like Copilot in VS Code, whenever you're working with that, that's making some of the best software engineers I know 30, 40, 50% more productive. So what do you do with this additional time? Right. So I think we will always constantly keep redefining what is it that our objectives are, what our goals are. And I think that's great because sometimes it's just so easy to sit down and get in a rut that I'm doing this because I've always done this. But mm-hmm. when you're forced to interact with these tools that make you a better version of you, maybe that gives us a little bit of more creativity to think about what is something unique that I can add to the world if I'm not constrained to just writing code for 40, 50 hours a week. So I don't know where we are going as a field, as a society, but I think if we take a cautiously optimistic approach to get there, I think there could be a lot of exciting new possibilities that we can unlock, just because now humans will have more time to be human rather than sitting down in our repetitive routines that we tend to have. And I think that's exciting, scary also, because there's a lot of uncertainty, but I always try to see the glass as half full, so we can hopefully see where that takes us.
I have a question for you. So much of the work that's done in computer vision, in deep learning around imaging is on natural images, right? Which is obviously a very different domain than medical imaging and a lot of what you deal with. Are there any techniques or tools that, you know, the natural image folks have that you're jealous about in the medical imaging space?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that question and asking myself that question for the past few months too. And I think my most recent answer is the access to computational resources is probably what I am most jealous about. And it's not just the question of having a few A100s that you can spin up at any given time. I think it's the fact that this is all patient data. So this is all private, this is all confidential. We have large data sets. You know, I work at Stanford Hospital. We have a fantastic IT team that allows us to get access to data relatively quickly so that we can do research. But being able to scale some of that computational infrastructure, being able to use that data with different cloud providers, I think there's a lot of hoops that we have to jump through. And I think rightfully so, because you know, we are very fortunate and blessed to be able to work with patient data, to be able to follow the lives of so many patients. But compared to colleagues who are working on ImageNet and compared to colleagues who are working in Lion, there's less protections that we have to think about from a data governance standpoint. So while I respect all the data sets and the privacy laws, I think that's what maybe makes me a little bit jealous about how easily one can compile data sets and just start using them. I think there's a lot of work to be done to be able to enable those similar processes in healthcare. But I fundamentally see why those challenges exist, right? Because HIPAA is a very, reasonable thing to be able to care about. So we always have to be able to work within these constraints. And I imagine if all the people in the world had access to healthcare data sets the way they do with ImageNet and with Lion and the Pile, I think the pace of advances that we'll see will just be massive. So I think that's almost a responsibility on people like me and other people at academic centers to see how can we help with that? You know, how can we help people across the world get access to this data so that everyone can do the research? What we're seeing over the past 5-10 years is if you put data sets online, people are committed enough and people have time to be able to work on those. So why not create these large data sets for the community? Why not inform them about what can we actually do with this data? How can we try to solve real clinical questions? But that, we're not there yet. And I'm excited to be able to do my part, to be able to help get the field over there too.
And you've done some work on creating some of these data sets, is that right?
That's true, yeah. So we've been, this is something that is a, we care deeply about this, you know, at Stanford and at the Stanford AIMI Center. Our whole ethos is, not only are we trying to do high quality research, but how can we enable the community to also have the same tools that we have access to? So we've been involved with creating data sets so that we can take data that was acquired at Stanford Hospital. We can compile the relevant patient information, the patient outcomes, and then working with the Stanford Privacy Office, working with our Institutional Review Board, release these data sets so that the broader public can start utilizing this. It is a challenging process. It takes a lot of time that you're not necessarily always incentivized for, but we feel strongly about it. And it's been really nice that once we've released a data set, we've had a very great response from the community. They've started using these data sets in ways that we had never even thought about. And I think that's really the benefit that I see of being able to provide to the community, because we typically have a pretty narrow focus on what can we do with the tools we have. I always feel like I have blinders on and sometimes I'm scared to look to the right or left. But if I just put some of our tools out there, there's 100 people in the world that are smarter, more creative than us. So why not have them the ability to work with us? So it's a slow process, but hopefully a rewarding process. But maybe ask me again in 5 or 10 years and maybe my answer might be different.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting because we have seen so much progress happen so quickly as a result of open source, right? Certainly in the past, you know, 9 or so months. And so to your point, I think we really see the power of just getting so many eyeballs and so many kind of brains working on data sets or models that it's cool to think about what if all of those minds could be targeted towards improving medical imaging and improving kind of health outcomes.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. And I really almost see this as a democratization of knowledge. You know, if we look at how healthcare research was performed even 10, 15 years ago, you know, I don't think you need to have a PhD or a master's or an advanced degree to be able to meaningfully contribute to the world. If we have a potential of just open sourcing some code, open sourcing some data sets, people all over the world, regardless of what their background is, will have unique insights. They'll have unique skills of their own. So why not have them use all of this? It's fascinating, you know, in the Bay Area too. I get emails. I see lots of applications of high schoolers working on very impactful projects too. So I think all of this really has been enabled by the open source nature of software as well as data sets. And I think those concepts will only get better over time. So we really have to rethink what is the role of education, what is the role of universities, research centers. But I think that's a fun and challenging problem to have.
And talking about the future, so what does the future of education look like? What do you think the future of computer vision looks like? You know, project out, maybe not all the way to infinity, but project out to the future. Are we still going to be collecting and labeling data? Are we still going to be training models in the way we think of that today? What is the future of computer vision?
I'm really starting to see, and I don't think this is a unique observation in any way, that fields like natural language processing and computer vision, which were traditionally viewed as relatively disparate fields, are now coming together. A lot of the tools that we're using in both these communities are starting to merge. And I think a lot of data sets that we're working with also are moving towards this multimodal understanding. And I think that's where I really see the future going. Because if we think about humans, we don't perceive just by seeing. We perceive by listening, we perceive by feeling, by touch. And there's a lot of potential to get additional data beyond just visual data. There's a new class of models that are coming out almost every day that are multimodal in the sense that they have vision elements, language elements, audio, inertial motion units, amongst others. So I really feel that that's where the field is heading towards. Mm-hmm. Instead of thinking about this from a singular modality perspective, what are the insights that we can extract when we combine these multiple modalities better? How can we extract meaningful representations from language and have those help some of our visual representations and vice versa? And how can we scale this to other broader modalities? I think that's where the field is slowly but surely heading. Mm-hmm. It's constrained by compute and data, but I don't see those being as long-term problems. You know, I'm sure things could be better short-term, but since there's enough incentives and excitement, I imagine that nearing infinity, we'll be able to fix a lot of those issues. And to your question about training models, do we still need to label data? Maybe that depends on the application a little bit and how that interplays with what sort of data sets you have. You know, if we imagine that most of the data 10 years from now is still in the natural domain, then maybe we'll still have to label some data in healthcare. But instead of needing to label 10,000 examples of something, can I get by labeling 10? Can I get by maybe labeling 50? Mm-hmm. So maybe we'll still need labeling, but I imagine that the extent of labeling that we need to do will be substantially lower because of the new tools that we've been able to build. And if we get to a scenario where we can do a lot of zero-shot understanding, that would be fantastic. But, you know, maybe that shouldn't be the goal. Even if I have to label 10 exams, that's doable. So if the cost to build a model that requires 10 labels per class is significantly smaller than building a model that has zero-shot understanding, pick your battles. Just label those 10 examples, deploy those models, and move on to other challenging questions. So that's how I think the field might scope out. But yeah, I think it'll be good to revisit this conversation in 10 years and give both of us a report card of how bad we are at predicting the future.
So I think you bring up a great point of if it's just 10 images, right? It's not too big of a lift. You've done some work on having big models, label small models, student models, teacher models. Is that the future of labeling? Will models kind of be doing the labeling for us?
Potentially. I think that's something we're definitely excited to be able to explore. And at the end of the day, everything just revolves around trade-offs. You know, what is a trade-off between labeling and what sort of accuracy you might expect? And those thresholds will be different for different applications. So we're just trying to understand, you know, if we have these student-teacher models or distillation-style models, what knowledge does your, you know, teacher model have? And what knowledge do you expect your smaller student model to have? And how does that relate to the tasks that you care about? And, you know, that's this new workflow that we're trying to think about within the group is a lot of times, a lot of the ML benchmarks that we care about, they're very like task specific. So what is my classification performance on my ImageNet data set? Mm-hmm. You know, that's a good guidepost, but I don't think that should be the end point of how we look at data sets and models. I think it's really nice to be able to look at broader workflows. Now, let's say if I'm building a classification model for a healthcare application, what happens when my model gives me a particular classification output? Who acts on that information? What are their biases? What are the knowledge bases that they have? And once you have a person acting on the decision from a model, what happens next? You know, what is the next trigger in the clinical workflow that gets engaged? So it's really a long chain of events. So if we can say, or if we can compute, well, what does a different accuracy for my classification model actually end up manifesting to in terms of the full workflow, I think that's a really nice way to think about things. Challenging to do because you really need that full-scale integration. But that's where I'm personally excited to move towards too, where instead of looking at a singular focus, let's really benchmark our tools on how is that model being used in a prospective setting.
Interesting. And this gets at, so it's a big topic, how do we evaluate models? And maybe explain how are models being evaluated today and how do you think they should be? Is what we're doing today the right way or you think that needs to change?
I think what we're doing today is correct, but in a very small subset of evaluations. So I think like I described, a lot of models that I see coming out in healthcare, they'll compute things like what is your AURC or what is your precision recall value. Very helpful guideposts to be able to understand, is my model good enough? But it doesn't really give you any information about how will this model actually be used in the full clinical workflow. And I think that's what our evaluations really need to take into account. And right now, our evaluations are too coarse to be able to understand that full workflow. And you know, maybe I'll just give an example of some of the work that we're doing with right now. We're trying to take some of our abdominal CT scans and trying to predict risk of future cardiovascular disease. And we do the typical things. We take some data sets, we split them into train, validation, and testing cohort, build models, and then evaluate their performance in terms of AURC, precision recall, in our test set. That gives us some very reasonable but coarse idea about what the performance is. But then when we go talk to our cardiologist, they might say, hey, your test set is too diverse. when I think about patients, I really try to stratify them in terms of what sort of pre-existing conditions do they have? How many times have they presented to the clinic? You know, what have their chief complaints been? So instead of our benchmarks is pooling all these patients into one big bucket, you know, each patient really is unique. You know, each patient has a very different life story. Each patient have different conditions that they come in with. So if we can benchmark our models based on these unique stories, you know, can we at least think about different covariates and these different subgroups that exist within our testing sets and be able to say that, hey, on average, my model may not be good enough, but for this specific subgroup, you know, maybe it's patients who have diabetes, they have high, you know, they have hypertension, and they have a family history of cardiovascular disease. In that group, maybe your model is helpful if you stratify and restrict your patients just to that. So I feel like being able to really look at subgroup performance will be important. And then being able to evaluate multiple different metrics of model performance, I think, is useful. And a lot of this, I think, is inspired by really nice work that's being done at Stanford outside of healthcare. So Percy Liang and team are leading the Center for Research on Foundation Models. And they recently put out a beautiful paper called Holistic Evaluation of Language Models. And that is, I think, a really good example of how we should benchmark models, because they used, I forget how many language models they're using, but many tens of language models are evaluated for this across a variety of different evaluation criteria. So how factually correct are these models? You know, how empathetic are some of these models? How do they work across different subgroups? So a lot of times, I feel like we try to simplify performance to one number. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have one numbers, but that number sometimes isn't expressive enough to give you an understanding of the true utility. So while it's good to compile some aggregate statistics, it's also nice to be able to have multiple different metrics of performance from different perspectives. And I really feel like that is what is lacking in healthcare. But this is changing. I think a lot of people have been inspired by how people are evaluating, you know, newer language models, you know, prior language models, generative models, and really thinking of not just a single number, but a suite of different metrics that can help you evaluate and aggregate what some of these benchmarks are. So I'm very excited for that. And I'm excited to participate in that research to be able to help push the community to be able to learn these good evaluation criteria.
What's been cool to see on the language model side, to your point, is so much of the evaluation that's having human raters kind of rate how, you know, the quality of the text that they see, which, you know, you do see a lot of, you know, some ephemeral quality of, you know, the quality of the text missing when you're just optimizing for, you know, certain scores or certain metrics. And it makes total sense that you need to bring that to medicine, to healthcare, when the ultimate goal is not just that single metric or number, but it's how useful is this in clinical settings.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fully agree that at the end of the day, if humans will be acting on these models, humans need to be able to come up with some guidelines and some signposts about are these useful or not. So that presents a whole other suite of challenges, you know, something that might be a bit more specific to healthcare data. You know, for, you know, generative text models right now, we can potentially have non-expert humans be able to rate the quality or the coherence of a given sentence. But then if we apply that same premise to healthcare models, then we probably need healthcare experts to be able to opine on that. And they're busy, they're constrained. So how can we best work around what we need and what the system is currently to be able to find the best of both worlds? I think that's tricky.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit. I feel like we could keep talking about this for hours more, but let's switch to more rapid fire questions. So the first question I had for you is, what AI paper from, let's say, the past 6 months are you most excited about? And this is something other than one of your own.
Yeah, no, I think other people's papers are always better than my paper. there was a really interesting paper that came out of Meta AI recently called ImageBind. And this goes towards this notion of multimodal representation learning. I think a prevailing thought in the field was if you have multiple different modalities, then it's really nice to be able to ground all the modalities in terms of its language representation. So let's say if I had images, if I had audio, and if I had language data, what I can do is I can convert my image embeddings and my audio embeddings to be aligned with my language embeddings. And language is a unifier across these multiple different modalities. That seemed to be the prevailing perspective, not conclusive in any way, but I think a lot of people probably felt the same way. But then this ImageMind paper came along and they said that, hey, actually, instead of thinking of language as the binding modality, let's think about images as this binding modality. And they showed some really nice use cases where you could represent video data using images, which I think makes sense as is intuitive, but being able to do the same for text data, being able to do that for heat maps, being able to do that for audio, as well as IMU data. So modalities that you wouldn't necessarily expect to have strong visual representations can in fact have strong visual representation. So I just thought that the idea was very refreshing and it kind of bucked the trends a little bit, which I always enjoy reading research along those lines. And I think just that whole research field is fascinating, and I'll cheat a little bit and try to talk about one more paper within a similar space, which is in contrast to being able to align all the embeddings into an image space. This paper is called CODI. For some reason, I'm blanking on what the acronym is. I think it's conditional diffusion. It was from UNC as well as Microsoft that has a very similar perspective, but from a generative capacity. If we're working with multiple different modalities at once, what is a nice unifying modality that you can represent all these findings through? And they went with the language embedding to be able to unify all these different tools. But now you need unpaired data sets to be able to train these models. So it doesn't matter if you have images only, video, audio, text, just put them in this massive pot, kind of stir it a little bit, represent everything in terms of language, and then you have really good generative capabilities. So those are the two papers that I'm particularly excited about because they help answer a pretty fundamental question about what is the best way to do multimodal representation learning. And this field will keep evolving. And I am very excited to see, you know, similar ideas, even if they propose completely different modalities, because every paper pushes the field to think about newer ideas. So I really enjoyed reading both those papers.
So cool. I have two new papers to add to my reading list. I love it.
Perfect. Yeah. Yeah. What are some of your papers that you liked over the past 6 months or maybe even a year?
Ooh, turning the tables. Well, mine, yeah. I think is fairly recent. I think I may have told you about this before, but the Voyager paper from maybe like 3 months ago. So it was NVIDIA. And it's essentially the most advanced AI agent built to date. The specific application that they had the agent do is play Minecraft. But the thing that was pretty mind-blowing to me is, first of all, concepts like AutoGPT or Baby AGI, people try to have like one LLM in a while loop that does everything. Part of what made Voyager so advanced is seeing the different LLMs that they had work in concert. So it's really an agent, an advanced agent is really an agent system. Mm-hmm. So that was really cool to see. And each kind of LLM has a very specific job in that entire kind of, in that entire agent's role. The other fascinating thing for me was how it really solidified this concept of like learning through reasoning, where, you know, prior to reading that paper, learning, I always thought meant backpropagation, right? Now, all of a sudden, because we have these LLMs, which are these reasoning engines, we can actually learn, you know, these agents can learn by reasoning about their environment, writing that information down and then building up a knowledge base over time. And that's how Voyager, this agent, is able to kind of advance in Minecraft, is figuring out base skills, writing that down, and then building on top, like, more advanced skills over time. And for me, that was magical because I now think about these models, not really how I used to think about models, but really as like a reasoning engine. They are essentially like our processor and, you know, for a computer. And then you can start to, like, the field will have to invent all these other components over time. So, you know, you have a processor, it's your reasoning unit, and then we have to invent flash and RAM and like all these other things that, you know, I'm using the analogy for computers, but you can see these components working in concert to make really cool advanced AI systems.
Yeah. And then maybe piggybacking off the question you had asked me about, you know, in the future, do you just see like one big model or multiple small models? Do you think that similar knowledge distillation process could be used here to build all the unique agents that are very good at the tasks that only one agent needs to know? Is that where you see the field moving?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think, yeah, these subsystems, what I'm seeing, and also just in kind of playing around with things myself, is I do think they need to be pretty specialized. I mean, even just deciding if a task has been completed, that's like a specialized, you know, set of reasoning steps that need to be completed. And so, yeah, you can either use a large model to kind of prompt it in the right ways, or, you know, if, you know, latency is a concern, cost is a concern, you know, like the deployment hardware, you're limited, you can, you know, distill from these big models into just very specialized, you know, mini LLMs. So yeah, I think that's probably how things will play out in the future with these agent systems. I still don't, in my mind, the future still probably looks like a few really massive embedding spaces. But in the short term, I think we'll just see, you know, millions of hyper-specialized small models.
That all very good at their one or two tasks, but then when you hopefully chain them together, they can perform like the big, you know, knowledge unit that they are.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So next question for you. What advice would you have for, let's say, someone who is technical, but doesn't work in AI right now, and they want to get into the field? Let's say they're either a software engineer or they have a PhD in some computational field. What advice would you have for them for getting into the field of AI?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it may also come down to what the person may want to get out of spending their time in the space of AI. Are they more interested in knowledge discovery? Are they interested in tool building? And I feel like these are really exciting times for both of these. You know, when I talk about knowledge building, I guess it's a little bit more similar to traditional, you know, academic research, understanding the whys and then the hows and being able to answer that. There's so many publicly available models. I think the benchmarks that we have for a lot of these models are non-ideal. So I think there's a lot of open opportunities for people to be creative in thinking about, well, what are some of the use cases that we haven't necessarily considered? How can I understand what model performance is like? And then using some of those insights, try to understand a little bit more about why the models perform, how they perform. So I think there's a lot of resources, just given the fact that it's a nice open source community. And I think it's a pretty tight-knit community at the end of the day. So that could be one application. Well, it's one area from the discovery side. But maybe for some people, you just want to build things and seek out some communities. You know, for example, Lion. There's a great extent of research that comes out from Lion, but it's such a grassroots community. There's a lot of researchers that are affiliated with Lion officially, but a lot of the work that they do is very community-driven too. So participate in some of these forums, learn about what are the tools that are out there, and be engaged. I think tools have never been more accessible than they are now, and that'll only keep getting better. So very exciting opportunities.
Is there anything like
Stanford online courses, Coursera, you know, if you were to recommend, like, here's a good kind of entrance into the space, just to kind of get your bearings.
Yeah, that's a good question too. So it depends on how much knowledge you're coming in with. I think there might be some people who are new to a lot of these fields. And I think really nice courses that are offered by Coursera, deeplearning.ai, that are nice introductions to some of these fields. And I think the other thing that Stanford does quite nicely is to provide a lot of its CS courses online for the world too. I think there might be a lag in terms of what quarters are available, but there's just a lot of coursework that is publicly available. If you go to, say, like the Stanford NLP class, you can see all the lectures that are provided, what all the homeworks are. That may be a little bit more challenging for someone who doesn't have any experience. So that could be a maybe stepping stone. You know, you take your Coursera class, learn about some of the fundamentals, and then take the Stanford equivalent version of the class and do the homeworks. Now, doing the homeworks is where the learning happens. It's ironic that I'm saying that because I would always complain about doing homework when I was a student. But looking back, that's how you really learn. You know, when you start debugging things, when things don't go according to plan, is where the learning process happens. So there's something to be said of just saying that I'm going to spend my time completely solving this problem. I still love the example homeworks that they have in the Stanford computer vision class, where you have to implement your own neural network from scratch, you know, forward passes as well as backprop. And then after that, they introduce you to tools like PyTorch and TensorFlow. But there's definitely something nice in really understanding how that pipeline works. And being able to build up step by step towards that can only help you going forward.
My feeling, certainly these past couple months, has been that it's kind of a full-time job to keep up with AI and progress in AI. How do you stay up to date with news and new publications, and what tips would you have for others?
Yeah, I definitely see that as a full-time job. I think my primary source of ML information is Twitter. I think people post a lot of their articles to Twitter. There's a lot of nice conversations that happen on there where people ask questions. You know, it's like a mini peer review process. And we can talk about all the pros and cons of the current peer review processes and maybe for a different conversation. But I feel like that's a nice way to track a lot of work. But then at the same time, I'm just very lucky to be able to work with all the students that I work with. They're always the ones who bring me up to speed with whatever is going on in the world. They have some of the best insights because they can spend time reading through the papers. They build connections. So I'm just very fortunate to be able to work with a fantastic group of students that help me stay on top of the field. And I think beyond that, it's challenging because there's just so many things that come out on any given day. And there's a lot of nice tools that help aggregate these. You know, the one that comes to mind is AK on Twitter, on now Hugging Face. So I definitely subscribe to his papers and his feeds quite a bit. But even then, going through 10 papers a day is not really manageable if you really want to sit down. So I think being in the community and having friends who are also thinking about the same things is nice.
So one of the secondary goals of this podcast is to spread the word about my favorite book of all time, The Beginning of Infinity by David Deutsch. And so if you're up for it, in the spirit of that, I wanted to read a quote from the book and then have you give your reactions to it.
Let's do it.
All right, awesome. So this is actually one of my favorite quotes from the book, and as a researcher, as an academic, as someone who spends time trying to understand, you know, the world, I'm really excited to get your reactions. So here it is. It is inevitable that we face problems, but no particular problem is inevitable. We survive and thrive by solving each problem as it comes up. And since the human ability to transform nature is limited only by the laws of physics, none of the endless stream of problems will ever constitute an impassable barrier. David Deutsch.
That's a really nice quote. And it's interesting because in a way, that's how we approach a lot of research questions in the group too. I feel like I always end up, whenever I'm talking to my students, I might say things like, you know, blah, 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 let's do something. This might be very challenging. And me saying that is actually just the most positive reaction that people can have, or at least that's how I think about problems, that it is challenging, let's do it. And I really feel like, you know, that's almost the role of academics these days, to be able to take some of these challenging problems and have a long-term view of being able to chip away at understanding what the answer should be. And in some situations, you'll succeed, but in some situations, you'll fail. And that's okay, because if we don't force ourselves to ask big questions, or if we don't force ourselves to undertake challenging activities, then we'll limit how quickly we can progress. So as long as we're okay with failure along the way, we should absolutely always go for trying to solve the most challenging questions of our time, because we're fortunate enough, at least in my setting, to have the resources and the infrastructure to ask some of those questions. And even if we can answer 1 out of 5, you know, that's still better than where we were yesterday. And you know, it's funny, we always joke around that if any of our experiments work on the first try, or if any of our studies work on the first try, we're not asking a hard enough question. So it really motivates us in the group and all my colleagues to ask big picture questions and to put ourselves out there and ask, well, what's the worst that can happen? We'll give it our best shot. And at worst, we fail, which is no different than where we started off with. But at best, we can help push the community forward. So I think a lot of the research that we do quite nicely resonates with that quote. And thank you for sharing that.
Amazing. I love it. Well, Akshay, this has been so much fun. I always love chatting with you. Where can people stay up to date with your work and anything you want to ask of our listeners?
Yeah, I think a few different places. Like I mentioned, a lot of the knowledge that I gain about the broader ML community comes from Twitter. So I'm relatively active about posting some of the latest and greatest that we do over there. We have a lab website, the Stanford Machine Intelligence for Medical Imaging Lab, or my Google Scholar profile. Even if I forget to update my website, Google Scholar always has my back. So that's always a nice place to see some of the latest tools that we're up for. And I'm always open to chat with people. You know, find me on Twitter, shoot me an email. There's always more interesting conversations to be had.
Thanks for listening to The Edge of Infinity, an AI podcast. You can find all show notes, transcripts, and resource links to all of our episodes at blog.infinity.ai. I'm your host, Lena Avancini Colucci. You can find me on Twitter at Lena_Colucci. That's LINA_COLUCCI. Thanks for listening, and until next time.